Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unprecedented vote tomorrow to hold the Attorney General in contempt of Congress based on trumped-up false charges pushed by the NRA, who are the main reason why illegal guns flow unfettered into Mexico. Yet the NRA is rounding up votes in Congress to blame Eric Holder for allowing guns to cross the border. Dennis Hennigan, the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy, joins us to discuss this breathtaking exercise of cynicism and hypocrisy underway on Capitol Hill. Then we'll look further into the disgraceful display of posturing and grandstanding in the House, who, instead of voting on making student loans more affordable and available, are engaged in a spurious partisan witch hunt. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Reports, joins us to discuss a real scandal involving student loans, where the biggest beneficiaries of the GI Bill, which is designed to help veterans, turns out to be the largely fraudulent for-profit college racket, which is raking in billions in taxpayer money while ripping off vets. Then finally, as Turkey escalates its warnings to Syria following the shooting down of a Turkish warplane, we will look into reports that question the plane's mission, which by some accounts might have been a provocation. Asli Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, joins us to discuss military escalation on the 550-mile-long border that Turkey shares with Syria. Joining us now is Dennis Hennigan, who is the vice president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and founder of the Center's Legal Action Project. He is the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Hennigan.
It's nice to be with you, Ian.
And Dennis, there's a really outstanding article at Fortune, The Truth About the Fast and Furious Scandal. Very, very thorough investigative piece of journalism by Catherine Eben. And I hope people in this country read it, because this whole idea that the United States Senate is going to waste their time tomorrow with holding the Attorney General in contempt, which is unprecedented, and a cabinet member in the United States has never been held in contempt by the Congress, and yet they're going to do it tomorrow, and largely because the NRA is rounding up the votes.
Well, you know, this is the best illustration I can think of why the American people are so dissatisfied with the way Washington works. Here you have this Fortune investigative piece that calls into question, you know, whether this so-called gun walking that was the subject of this alleged scandal ever actually occurred. I mean, the allegation here is that ATF knowingly allowed guns to cross the border, guns that they should have otherwise interdicted. But what this article points out is that our gun laws are so weak in this country that it's not at all clear that they would have had the legal authority to do this, to interdict them, that there was no purposeful walking of guns across the border. It was simply that ATF was incapable of doing its job because they've been handcuffed by our weak gun laws. But I think you really used the right word in your introduction. This is a celebration of Washington hypocrisy. These Republican leaders in the House, who are feigning so much concern over the approximately 2,000 guns that were the subject of this fast and furious operation that went into Mexico, sit on their hands and do absolutely nothing to pass stronger gun laws that would deal with the other 68,000 guns that have been trafficked from border state gun shops into Mexico over the last 4 years. Right now, straw buyers for these traffickers can walk into a Texas gun shop and walk out with 10 semi-automatic assault rifles equipped with high-capacity ammunition magazines. It should not be possible to buy a single assault rifle anywhere in this country. And for 10 years, it was in fact illegal for gun dealers to sell these weapons of war. But because of the gun lobby and its lackeys in Congress, that ban was not renewed. And you've got people like Daryl Issa, Speaker Boehner, You've got the other Republican leaders in the House who could expedite that kind of legislation to passage in an instant and who will do nothing to actually curb the problem. All they want to do is to find some way to cook up some kind of scandal to damage the Obama administration.
Again, I'm speaking with Dennis Hennigan, who is the vice president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and founder of the Center's Legal Action Project. He's the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy. Now, the Fortune article, The Truth About Fast and the Fast and Furious Scandal, just to give you, just to set up some of the context for this article, quoting from it. The Mexican government has estimated that 2,000 weapons are smuggled daily from the United States into Mexico. The ATF is hobbled in its efforts to stop this flow. No federal statute outlaws firearm trafficking, so agents must build cases using a patchwork of often toothless laws. For 6 years, due to Beltway politics, the Bureau has gone without permanent leadership, neutering it in its fight for funding and authority. The National Rifle Association has so successfully opposed a comprehensive electronic database for gun sales that the ATF's congressional appropriation explicitly prohibits establishing one. Now, is that a part of the Tyhart Amendment?
Actually, it's not. That was in existence long before the Tyhart Amendment.
Well, tell us about the Tyhart Amendment, because I think it's so egregious. It gives the audience an idea of how the NRA have successfully hobbled the ATF.
Yes, the Tyhart Amendment is one of the more recent enactments done at the bidding of the NRA. And what it did was it restricted public disclosure of data having to do with crime gun traces. The ATF has a huge database of information about crime guns that shows, for example, that a relatively small percentage of American gun shops account for a huge percentage of crime guns, which tends to suggest that we have a problem with rogue gun dealers, which ATF is unfortunately ill-equipped to shut down because they simply don't have the adequate legal power. And I have no doubt that some of those rogue gun dealers are aiding and abetting these traffickers to the Mexican cartels. The American people used to know a lot more about these patterns of gun trafficking because this data was readily available to researchers, to groups like ours, to law enforcement, to use the data to learn. But the NRA would rather pursue a know-nothing policy. They don't want the American people to understand how the illegal market in this country is fueled by rogue gun dealers, because that would say that the dealers have responsibility. In fact, the whole industry has responsibility because they knowingly sell to these dealers.
Yeah, but Dennis,
why it is very threatening to the gun lobby, and so they shut down public access to it.
But there is nothing more important than crime guns. They are the evidence. They've been used to murder people.
That's
and,
right.
And those are the things that law enforcement needs to try. I mean, we all watch those TV shows.
Yes. And
but it's not real. I mean, in other words, they can't share, the cops can't share this information.
And by definition, we're not talking about the guns used by law-abiding citizens. These are guns that have already been associated with criminal activity, found at crime scenes, taken from suspects. And much can be learned by tracing those guns to their origin to find out how they got into the hands of the criminals.
Sure, and the NRA...
And the NRA doesn't want people to know it.
And so let's then talk about what the NRA has done in terms of preventing... First of all, they've made sure the ATF hasn't had a leader now for over a decade, it seems.
Yes, I mean, the NRA has a long history of doing everything in their power to ensure that ATF is weak, that they do not have the adequate tools to enforce our gun laws, and that they are, in fact, intimidated, so that if they do enforce our gun laws, the NRA will threaten their appropriations through their, again, their control of these congressional representatives.
And that's basically what this whole Fast and Furious manufacture scandal is about, is that it's attempting to hobble them and discredit them even further. But what about the NRA's successful ability to stop the comprehensive electronic database of, on gun sales.
Well, you know, it's ridiculous because it's a product of the NRA's paranoia about gun records. The NRA deals very well in fear, and what they have tried to do is to generate among gun owners fear that if the government has records that establish who owns what guns and when they own them, the same way that the government has records of who owns what cars, that if they have those records, why the government will turn around and they will confiscate those guns. And so this paranoia is used to defeat any effort to have comprehensive record keeping that would enhance crime gun tracing and that would also establish the accountability of people for what happens with their guns. If one of your guns is used in a criminal act, we ought to be able to establish whether you're accountable for that gun at all, or whether, in fact, you might have sold it to somebody else, or you might have lost it or had it stolen. We ought to have the records to know that kind of thing in an instant. That would be in the interest not only of law enforcement in catching the criminals, but also in the interest of law-abiding citizens who want to be able to establish that they had nothing to do with that gun being at a crime scene. But this kind of accountability is impossible because the NRA has blocked every effort to create the kind of comprehensive record keeping that would allow it.
Well, as I say, as I mentioned, this article in Fortune, the truth about the Fast and Furious scandal, is so important for people to understand, and because all of the microphone has been in the hands of Daryl Issa, and the conservative world, the bubble created by Fox, they all believe this stuff. That this is the new Watergate and that Obama's covering up something dreadful here, and there's absolutely no there. And in fact, the real lesson is that it is the power of the NRA that has hobbled the ATF so much, and this whole phony scandal has hobbled them even further. And meanwhile, the guns, these automatic weapons, are crossing the border, and you know, in this article it points out that that the ATF found a young homeless guy paying $10,000 for a sniper rifle with a 50-caliber sniper rifle that could take down a 747. That's how the criminals are operating.
Well, that's right, and it shouldn't even be possible to buy a 50-caliber sniper rifle in this country. And there is legislation pending in the U.S. House that would ban those kinds of guns, but the very Republican leaders who are pursuing Attorney General Holder are the very people who will block any effort to push legislation like that through the U.S. House of Representatives. And I can't emphasize enough the rank hypocrisy of these people who sat in a joint session of Congress 2 years ago and heard the President of Mexico pleading with the Congress to do something to strengthen U.S. gun laws to prevent the slaughter of his citizens. And I have every reason to believe that Speaker Boehner and Daryl Issa and Leader Cantor sat on their hands when he made that plea, and they have done nothing to respond to his plea, and nothing to save the lives of those Mexican families and other American law enforcement who have been killed by guns that have nothing to do with Fast and Furious.
Well, and meanwhile, of course, the NRA are rounding up votes, and particularly Democratic votes, for tomorrow's unprecedented censure of a cabinet member, in this case, the Attorney General Eric Holder. I mean, I can't recommend this article in Fortune enough, because it really does, for the first time, show you the utter absurdity of these claims. And it also, I think, to some extent, it makes CBS look bad, because they got taken in by a disgruntled ATF agent who gave them this extremely biased piece of evidence that they ran with that turns out to be bogus.
Yes, and also part of this history is that this alleged scandal first surfaced in the far right-wing blogosphere. In fact, on a website that is controlled by the very individual who called on people to throw bricks through the glass windows of Democratic headquarters around the country at the height of the health care debate. And in fact, there were many attacks on Democratic headquarters across the country in response to that. So this all originated with the far militia right, and that should be kept in mind as well.
Well, Dennis Hennigan, I guess tomorrow they're going to vote to censure the Attorney General. But do you think this story, like the piece of investigative journalism that Fortune magazine's done, the truth about the Fast and Furious scandal, you think it's eventually going to come out?
I think that it's a very significant story, and I wouldn't be surprised if it inspires other outlets to do follow-up investigations. We still are awaiting the Department of Justice Inspector General's report on this, and that may also clarify some matters. But this Fortune article presents a completely different perspective, because all that Daryl Issa heard was one side of the story, and apparently there are ATF agents in that Phoenix office who will completely contradict the testimony of the agents that some of the agents that appeared before ICE's committee. So we're not to the bottom of this yet, and it'll be very interesting to see what develops.
Well, thank you for joining us, Dennis Hennigan.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dennis Hennigan, who's the vice president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and the founder of the Center's Legal Action Project. He's the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the GI Bill meant to help veterans is being used to make the for-profit college racketeers rich.
Shot the sheriff, but I swear it wasn't self-defense. Yeah. I said, I shot the sheriff, oh Lord, and they say there's a capital offense. Ooh, 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 yeah.
To get a job and show he wasn't scared. Someone's got half a handicap, he thought he'd be prepared. He's forced to choose. At the age of 21, he's in catch 22.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter, and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Ian, how are you? It's good to be back on the show.
Well, I'm pretty sort of steamed up in a way, because I just talked about this phony and bogus censure vote tomorrow, first time in American history that the cabinet members were going to be held in contempt of Congress based on trumped-up false charges, which this excellent article in Fortune magazine completely eviscerates.
Right.
But there's another disgraceful display of posturing and grandstanding in the House. And instead of voting on student loans to make them affordable and available, we find that then, in fact, the real scandal here in student loans is that the biggest beneficiary of the GI Bill, which is designed to help veterans, turns out to be these largely fraudulent for-profit college rackets. They're raking in billions of taxpayer money while ripping off our vets. So I'm doubly mad. I'm like Howard, what's his name in that movie? I was mad as hell.
Well, I'm limited to two things. A whole bunch of things we could talk about to get us mad.
Right.
But instead of getting mad, we ought to do something about it. And so I'd love to talk with you more about this issue and talk about what I think people could do this summer on the issue of for-profit colleges, and particularly our veterans, to try to turn the tide on this thing.
Well, go ahead.
Well, what they ought to do, and we can talk about the substance, because you're right, there's $9 billion in this GI Bill, post-9/11 GI Bill, and almost 40% of it is going to for-profit colleges. Some are honest. Many are just a racket that are ripping off students, ruining their lives. All in all, this industry is getting $32 billion a year of your tax money, and many of it, again, goes to bad schools. Out of the money that goes to active duty military, about half of it is going to for-profit colleges. Today in Washington, it was announced a bunch of attorneys general from states and a bunch of senators, U.S. senators, did a press conference. A website got shut down because of a lawsuit today, a settlement of a lawsuit. It was called GIBill.com. It looked very much like an official government website, but it wasn't. It was a marketing company called Quinn Street, which used to market subprime mortgages, now markets subprime colleges, telling people, steering people to colleges that paid for the privilege rather than colleges that were necessarily good colleges. And they were all for-profit colleges. So this website got shut down, and GIBill.com will be rightfully transferred to the Department of Veterans Affairs, which will hopefully give people honest information. But the saddest thing, Ian, is that the state attorney general has to act on an industry that's largely funded by federal money because Congress is paralyzed. Why is Congress paralyzed? Senator Dick Durbin said at this press conference, which I attended, he made it very clear what's going on. Little or nothing can be done when you take on the for-profit colleges in Congress. Why? These were the key six words of the press conference. They own every lobbyist in town. They own every lobbyist in town, and as the senator said, many of them are former members of Congress, and the attorneys general said in turn, well, many of the people who lobby us are former attorneys general. They're lobbying for waste, fraud, and abuse with federal tax money and abuse of our veterans and other low-income and struggling people, and they're doing it for the money.
But this is a license theft. They got their fists into the Treasury because they've essentially bribed the political gatekeepers to allow them to do this, and they're doing this in the name of education, and this is $34 billion that we're talking about, and there's a desperate need, and it has echoes of the subprime, because remember, the people who got hosed in the subprime ripoff were largely aspirants to the middle class, mostly minorities, and many of these veterans who served this country who are then, aspiring to have an education just like the GI Bill was originally, and they find themselves being charged much, much more and ending up with worthless diplomas. And even though the taxpayer gets ripped off to the tune of up to $17,000 per year, the tuition at these private schools exceeds that. So veterans have to take out loans to cover the balance.
Right.
And then, of course, the default rate is 47%.
And this week, the government released statistics. There's a regulation that President Obama tried to get going, and it got watered down by pressure from lobbyists. And that says that if two-thirds of your students, former students, dropouts and graduates, can't pay back their loans, then maybe you shouldn't get federal financial aid anymore. But you have to flunk that test 3 years in a row, and you have to flunk two other related tests. And many, many schools, they did the first year of testing on this. It was really just more like a preseason because this won't kick in until 2015. But many of the schools flunked the test, and all of the schools that flunked the test were for-profit colleges. Why? Because they have high prices, low quality. They have thousands of recruiters and very few people to do job placement. And again, they're ruining people's lives. So here's what I think people ought to do at town hall meetings or any opportunity to talk to your member of Congress. You can go to Republic Report and see whether there's some key votes on these issues, whether your member of Congress voted with the for-profit colleges against them in the House. In the Senate, there haven't really been any votes. But go there and ask them, do you stand with our veterans, with our active duty military, with our low-income people who are struggling to get an education? Or do you stand with wealthy for-profit colleges that are owned by private equity firms and Goldman Sachs and the Washington Post company? Who do you stand with on this issue? Because the members of Congress now feel that no one's watching this issue. The only people watching are the for-profit colleges who are donors, major donors to their campaign, and lobbyists who come in and buttonhole them. And what we want people to do, and what I want people to do, and people I work with, is to tell the members of Congress that citizens are watching, we care about this, and there's a cost for voting with the for-profit colleges on issues of accountability. We're not saying shut down for-profit education. We're saying stop trying to fight rules that would channel money to schools that are helping students and away from schools that are ruining students' lives.
But this is the most mendacious form of socialism, and all in the name of free enterprise. I see on television now these new schools you've never heard of, and they have these glossy commercials. And every time I watch them, I'm reminded this is my taxpayer money. This is our taxpayer money that's being
paying
used.
For the schools, paying for the ads.
Paying for the ads. And then, I'm speaking with David Halpern, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He previously was the director of Campus Progress and a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, a senior policy advisor to Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, just to give you an idea of the money involved here, the VA paid out to these for-profit colleges $4.4 billion for the two academic years, 2009 to 2011. The for-profit colleges raked in 37% of that. And just an idea of how the money was spent. From 2009 to 2011, the VA paid $196 million to the University of Phoenix, $175 million to ITT Tech, $128 million to DeVry University, $50 million each to Kaplan and the Arts Institute, $28 million to Westwood College. And during that same period, they paid $20 million to the University of California, $15 million to the State University of New York, and Harvard got $3.6 million from the GI Bill, and Princeton University got $173,000. I mean, the distortion there is extraordinary between real educations and these rip-off educations.
Well, Princeton, unfortunately, is not going to admit many people coming from, enlisted people in the military because they're, in a way you could argue, well, it's snobby to say, Princeton should get all the money from the GI Bill because it is hard to get into those schools, and so we don't. I don't want to say that Princeton and Harvard deserve all the money. What I want to say is that community colleges, state institutions, and private institutions, including Harvard, Princeton, are better places to get an education for the most part than a for-profit college, and it's certainly at a much more reasonable price. And it is because of deceptive recruiting tactics like this GIBill.com and many other examples that people are choosing schools that are really not the right school for them. And one of the best things about the fact that for-profit colleges have fought so hard on this issue is that there has been more of a debate, and hopefully through things like your radio show, TV investigations, and some really good work by local TV channels and others on these issues, that more people are getting the message. Because it's hard to speak out because the students who've gone through this are ashamed a lot of the time. They've really been ripped off and their lives have been set back and they don't really want to talk about it. But the more that the media can talk about it, the more that it can encourage former students to come forward and talk about their experiences, the more people get educated. Even if Congress is stymied, more people are voting with their feet. And in fact, for many of these schools, enrollment is down, revenue is down, because at some point the truth has to come out and have an impact on these things.
Well, as we speak, David Halpern, the House, the Senate have agreed and the White House have agreed on making student loans more affordable and available, and the House is holding it up. So we don't really know but what's going to happen there. But we do know that this is already underway, and that the for-profit college industry, which is, being promoted by Wall Street, have the town wired, have Washington, D.C. wired. But what gets me, though, is that I wish there were some honest people that actually were getting into this business. There's a ton of emeritus professors out there in retirement across this country. There are a lot of highly educated people in this country that would love to teach and have a lot to give. You could actually create a wonderful a campus that really could deliver. You could get excellent people. And the idea that you have these fly-by-night people that just put up a shingle, make these glossy advertising campaigns, all of which is paid for by the taxpayer. I mean, this is an amazing racket that you can actually simply get your fists into the treasury and just siphon off money. And you know, it makes a mockery of the free enterprise system. And it's the very thing that all of these red-blooded conservatives in this country are against. This is crony socialism.
It's waste, fraud, and abuse with federal money. But, you know, and there are fly-by-night companies, one recently raided by the FBI. Congressman Alcee Hastings had taken money from them. They named a scholarship after him, and then it was raided by the FBI. Some are fly-by-night, but again, some are owned by Goldman Sachs, the Washington Post Company, a giant company called Apollo that owns the University of Phoenix. And one of them, TA Associates, is a private equity firm. It owns Vassar College, which was one of the worst performers, according to statistics released this week by the Department of Education, and it owns Full Sail University. TA Associates is a big contributor, its executives, to Mitt Romney's campaign. When they asked Mitt Romney last fall, what are you going to do about higher education, he said, I visited a wonderful school called Full Sail University, and Full Sail University keeps costs down through innovative strategies. Well, a couple weeks ago, statistics showed that Full Sail University is the third most expensive college in the United States. And many of the students come out, some get jobs, some don't. The programs are mixed. One of their programs flunked the Department of Education's test that I talked about this week. It's expensive, and Mitt Romney said it was a bargain. And it turned out not only did they give a ton of money to Mitt Romney's campaign and Super PAC, but Mitt Romney and his son started an investment firm that gave clients the opportunity to invest in this very company. So I'm bringing all this up to say to you that Mitt Romney talks about free market solutions, sure. But in fact, this is just the kind of thing that you talked about, crony capitalism or socialism, and that's his future of education. So right, I think those of you that are trying to consider this issue this fall ought to be asking Mitt Romney hard questions about his support for Full Sail University, University of Phoenix, and other schools like this, and asking the same questions of Democrats and Republicans who have supported this industry.
Right, and EDMC, which is owned by Goldman Sachs, the head of it is the husband of Senator Olympia Snowe, and it's under investigation and maybe the reason why she resigned. I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Halperin.
Ian, thank you for having me on.
Good to talk to you. Again, David Halperin is a senior fellow at Republic Report, previously the founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor to Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about whether the shoot down of the Turkish plane by the Syrians was a provocation.
Shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. True for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who is an American citizen of Turkish descent. She's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thanks very much.
And there are some second thoughts coming in about the shootdown of the Turkish reconnaissance plane by Syria, by Syrian air defences, which of course led to a NATO meeting one notch below a call for NATO intervention or joining in with Turkey. What do you make of some of the second thoughts from some of the NATO, American and allied officials privately asking questions about what was the mission for the Turkish warplane, even suggestions by some that it may have been a provocation or at the very least it was on a spy mission?
Yeah, so the New York Times did report today that American and allied officials thought that the Turkish warplane may have been on a spy mission, and that's consistent with speculation in the Turkish media that has focused on the murkiness of several of the details of what actually happened. The accounts that are given by Turkey and Syria are not only conflicting, but the Turkish account also appears to conflict with some of the evidence that's undisputed. So, for example, Turkey has insisted that the Turkish fighter jet only strayed into Syrian airspace very briefly and that it was shot down 13 nautical miles outside of Syria's land border, which would place it one nautical mile beyond Syria's airspace. But the wreckage is quite clearly not only within Syria's territorial waters, but actually quite close to the border. So just logistically, how it's possible that it was shot and then somehow the wreckage ended up so far from the point that the Turks claim the jet was located at the time of the shooting is something that the Turkish media has been raising as a question. Another question is that the Turkish government has said that the jet was on an ordinary routine mission to test Turkey's radar systems, and yet it appears in the media reports in Turkey that this plane was not equipped for such a test. And in fact, it has been acknowledged by the spokesperson of the foreign ministry, Bülent Arınç, that the fighter jet, which was an F-4 Phantom fighter jet, was in fact equipped for surveillance, despite the fact that the Turks are denying that it was on a surveillance mission. So all of this raises a series of questions that I think any careful analyst would have to say suggest that it may very well have been the case that the circumstances around the fighter jet's mission were not those that were alleged by the Turks, and indeed that the fighter jet may very well have been, as the Syrians claim, in Syrian airspace at the time that it was shot down.
Well, there are also reports that the Turkish warplane may have been shot down by Syrian anti-aircraft guns mounted on the shore, which would, and they only have a range of about 1 to 2 miles. So that would indicate it was actually much closer. The initial report said it was a sophisticated Russian ground-to-air missile. What's your understanding, or at least what's the speculation?
Yes. Again, the Turkish media is rife with speculation around this as well. The wreckage is currently within the control of Syria, again, as I've mentioned, because it's in Syria's territorial waters. The location is only being described not only in the Turkish media but also in the Western media in terms of the depth of the plane's wreckage as opposed to its proximity to the border. So we know that it's at a certain depth, but there is no verified claim in the West as to its proximity. But the Syrians have been very clear that it is within 2 nautical miles of their border, the wreckage, and that indeed they claim that it was shot by ground-based machine gun fire that would only have had a range of 2.5 kilometers, which is essentially 1 nautical mile, given the way that the correspondence works between nautical miles, which again are different than miles. The calculation is somewhat confused by the fact that different parties are invoking kilometers, miles, and nautical miles. But in any case, what remains to be verified is the actual location of the wreckage, and once that is verified, the tail, which has been recovered apparently, needs to be examined by a third party. The Turks are insisting it was hit by a missile. The Syrians are claiming that there are holes in the tail of the jet that verify that it was struck by machine gun fire that could not have had a range that would have reached even the limits of Syria's airspace, but rather would suggest that the jet was very close to Syria's land border. And if that were in fact true, if one could establish that the tail wreckage did reflect such holes, then the Syrian claims would be quite seriously substantiated.
Well, this doesn't in any way let the Syrians off the hook in terms of their being on a hair trigger. And my understanding is from intelligence sources that there was quite a vigorous effort on the part of former French President Sarkozy, along with Saudi Defense Minister Prince Salman, who's now been elevated to the Crown Prince because of the death of Prince Nayef, that they both weighed in on Obama just before the French elections. I guess Sarkozy was trying to pull off some kind of October surprise to stop his defeat there. They apparently had offered a plan for the aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle to use its warplanes to attack Assad's palace on a mountaintop, and along with the Saudis coming across with their aircraft across the Jordanian border. And they wanted the U.S. to use electronic countermeasures to suppress the Syrian air defenses, which apparently are quite sophisticated, because apparently Obama thought that the whole thing was kind of harebrained. So whether or not that's true, what's your explanation of why the Syrians are on such a hair trigger?
So I think, in fact, that if the Syrians interpreted the Turkish fighter jet's presence as a combination of a surveillance mission and a testing of Syria's defensive capacity, they would wish to illustrate very clearly that they do have a robust air defense capacity, quite distinct from what the resources that were available to Libya, precisely to head off the kind of allegedly humanitarian intervention to establish a no-fly zone, which would basically mean an attempt to take out the air defenses of Syria, as had been the case in Libya. In Libya, that proved to be a relatively easy task for NATO because Libya's air defenses were quite limited. But I think Syria might wish to establish that would not be the case should Syria be attacked in a similar fashion in an attempt to establish a no-fly zone. So I think Turkey's goals may very well have been to test Syria's defensive capacities if indeed the flight of that jet was intended to be a kind of test balloon, if you want. And what has resulted is a provocation that Turkey may now use to expand its margin of maneuver, both in that this crisis has already stiffened international resolve against the Assad regime by virtue of the fact that NATO did have a consultation, Turkey did invoke Article 4, and NATO has now said that it's remaining apprised of the situation and will continue to monitor it and so forth. Basically, the Turks have laid a predicate for potential future NATO involvement, and that may have also been a goal. So given that there's no dispute that the Turkish fighter jet flew into Syrian airspace, the likelihood that any one of these scenarios may well have been what motivated that mission suggests that the Syrians' response may also have been calibrated to their concerns about international intentions with respect to their airspace.
Again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who's an American citizen of Turkish descent, and she's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. Now, Syria and Turkey share a 500-mile-long border, a substantial border, and I take it that there's been an awful lot of activity on that border for some time. There's an enormous number of refugees. Some very senior Syrian military officers apparently only defected last week, including a general and a bunch of colonels. And what you're suggesting here, Asla Bali, is that the Turks now will have a military, not just bolster their military presence on that border, but they may in fact be able to claim some of Syria's airspace in terms of a defensive maneuver? In other words, put up a buffer zone there?
Well, I don't think they will claim Syrian airspace, in fact, because it doesn't appear that it's going to be a buffer zone that's defended from the air. But what the Prime Minister of Turkey, Prime Minister Erdogan, stated yesterday, first is that, and he's this is a translation from the New York Times, he was quoted as saying, at a time, place, and method of its choosing, Turkey will take steps against Syria in retribution for the downing of the jet. So what that tells you, first of all, is that Turkey is banking this as a basis to be invoked in future for engaging in an act of retribution against Syria. That's one. Two, the Turks have said that they are going to redouble their support to the Syrian resistance and Syrian opponents generally, both the Syrian National Council, the civilian political face of the Syrian opposition, and the Free Syrian Army, which represents at least one portion of the military opposition to the Assad regime, are headquartered in Turkey. And the Turkish border, as you've said, has been extremely active, not only because of the transit of refugees and defectors, but also because Saudi and Qatari-financed arms are reportedly flowing freely across the 550-mile border. And indeed, also the New York Times has reported that CIA operatives are based on that border, potentially to offer logistical or other assistance on a covert basis to the Syrian militarized opposition. So that, those are the circumstances at the border prior to this incident. Since this incident, the Turks have also announced that they are going to change their rules of engagement and that they're specifically going to define movement within Syrian territory of Syria's military as a hostile threat to which Turkey is entitled to respond. What that means is that Turkey is imposing unilaterally the equivalent of what would be described as a no-drive zone for Syrian forces along the Turkish border. So in other words, they're saying that any ground movement of Syrian forces on their territory but near the Turkish border will be interpreted as a threat. What that means is that the Turks are essentially establishing a corridor 550 miles long along their border with Syria, where Syrian forces will not be able to operate, or if they do, they will be doing so at the risk of an engagement with the Turkish military. This is the equivalent of something that Turkey has been arguing for some time, namely the establishment of either, quote-unquote, a safe zone or, quote-unquote, a humanitarian corridor along the border. The Syrian objection to that is that this border has been used precisely for the stationing of militarized opposition that mount their military attacks from this area. And so they would regard such a safe zone as not an area to protect civilians or to protect Turkish national security, but rather to afford a much wider margin of maneuver to their armed opposition, which Kofi Annan has today described as an insurrection.
And the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, for the first time went on television and described the situation in Syria as a civil war following an attack on the government television and also Republican Guards barracks right inside of the capital, Damascus. But Asla Bali, I've also heard reports that in the past, since this uprising has been underway, that Syrian helicopters have crossed into Turkish airspace and in some cases in pursuit of those fleeing Syria.
Yes, that's right. The Turkish government reported for the first time that there were five instances of Syrian helicopters crossing into Turkish airspace. Now here, the airspace in question is along that land border, so it's not a matter of territorial waters and so forth, and that's a much, much narrower band of airspace. And also we're talking about helicopters which, by virtue of the technology, fly at a low altitude and are easily detected as opposed to a fighter. They're not describing fighter jets. So this would be action on the part of the Syrians in quote-unquote hot pursuit of what they deem to be individuals that have engaged in attacks and are now attempting to cross into Turkey to flee the counter-assault from Syrian forces. I think what the Turks have very clearly indicated now is that any such future crossing of even a tiny portion across the border into Turkish airspace would be deemed a hostile act and would be shot down. But beyond that, that's not remarkable in the sense that any state has the right in self-defense once it deems itself to be hostile to a neighbor to protect against the neighbor engaging in an incursion on its sovereign airspace or territory. But what's remarkable beyond that is that the Turkish prime minister has also invoked a right to treat targets within Syria as a threat and to actually neutralize them while in Syrian territory, which may also include Syrian airspace. So that, I think, is a move that would not ordinarily have been supported by international law, but by grounding it in the claim that Syria has engaged in a quote-unquote unprovoked act of aggression, which I think is the facts do not support that claim on the part of the Turkish government, but that is nonetheless what the prime minister has claimed and what NATO has offered support for despite the private misgivings of apparently American and allied officials. In light of that, Turkey is using that as a basis to assert a set of rights that it would not otherwise have under international law to generate a zone for their operation within Syrian territory and airspace.
Well, Asla Bali, you mentioned a little while ago that the CIA is involved in that border area, coordinating arms and logistics with the Free Syrian Army. And one would think that given the qualms that most analysts have about a post-Assad Syria and the possibility of a prolonged civil war, enormous amount of bloodletting. Syria apparently has one of the world's largest arsenals of chemical weapons. The idea you have a Somalia on the Mediterranean. There are all these kind of fairly dire scenarios out there. And I've always been puzzled why the U.S. and Turkey have allowed the Saudis to take the lead in arming the Free Syrian Army, because the Saudis have a real political agenda. We've seen what they've done in Egypt, where they essentially financed the Salafists who came out of nowhere and came in second in the parliamentary elections. They clearly have a political agenda, and the idea of Salafists and extremists taking over in Syria is not in the interests of anybody, except the Saudis, I guess.
So there are obviously, in terms of the actual actors on the ground in Syria, their goals are entirely related to a struggle for power within Syria. The Assad regime is seeking to maintain its control, and its opponents are seeking to topple the regime and establish an alternative regime of whatever nature. But in terms of the regional actors, I think the stakes are extremely different and have very little to do with political outcomes on the ground in Syria, and a great deal to do with regional strategic interests, spheres of influence, and so forth. So what is in fact happening, in my view, is that Syria has turned into a proxy war for regional influence, control, markets, access to ports, and so forth, between, on the one side, Sunni Arab states that are pro-U.S., together with Turkey, and on the other side, those states and actors that are aligned with Iran in the region and Russia. So those are that's the division, and within that prism, the fact that the United States and Saudi are aligned on the same side means that considerations about what happens in a day-after scenario within Syria are being subordinated to the goal of essentially viewing this in the kind of grand chessboard scheme as a way of eliminating a pro-Iranian regime and replacing it with a regime aligned with pro-American or pro-Sunni forces in the region. And Turkey appears to be acting in a relatively sectarian way as well. I think that the Turks probably do think that it's important that the opposition, both military and civilian, are based in and headquartered in Turkey, and that Turkey is playing an active role in coordinating aid, arms, and so forth, financing that's coming from Saudi Arabia, because they think ultimately, if Syria does end up becoming a sort of pro-Western Sunni regime, they would prefer to see it be of the nature that the Turks themselves envision for Syria than Salafi, than the kind of regime that Saudi Arabia might prefer. And as a result, there is a subsidiary competition here between different Sunni actors to assert their presence as an important regional actor. But really what's happening, I think, at the broadest level is a competition that is about the strategic interests of regional backers, Russia, Iran, the United States, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and so on, as opposed to the goals and tactics that are being adopted within the country by Syrian actors. So there's that divide, and that divide is producing something that I think represents a very serious moral hazard, which is both sides, whether it's Russia supplying Syria with helicopters and so forth, or Saudi, Qatar, Turkey, U.S. coordinating assistance in the form of arms and financial assistance and so forth, logistical, technical support to the Syrian opposition, are essentially encouraging movement further and further down the road of escalation in the military conflict that, as you say, President Bashar al-Assad has described now as a state of war in Syria. I think others, observers, have said this is a full-blown civil war at this stage, and we've seen at least 12,000 civilian deaths, and that may be an understatement. And if we continue down this road, the amount of time it's going to take for the Syrian militarized opposition to build the resources, operational capacity, logistical knowledge, and just expertise to mount effective operations that could match the capabilities of the Syrian military will be some time. And while that incremental process is going on, you can expect to see tens of thousands more Syrians, civilians, caught in the crossfire between these parties. And that is, to my mind, a worst-case scenario. But it is also potentially the most likely scenario at this stage, because what that amounts to is the lowest cost form of intervention for regional actors. So rather than incur losses themselves for their own materiel or their own personnel to funnel arms into your preferred actor on the ground and continue strengthening them in the hope that you will end up with something other than a Pyrrhic victory, that is going to be a mechanism, whether it's being pursued by Russia and Iran or by the United States and its Sunni Arab allies in Turkey, that will be a scenario through which you will maximize civilian deaths and minimize the likelihood of a secure and stable political outcome in Syria.
Well, just in closing, Aslab Ali, it would seem that Libya is a glaring example of the day-after scenario where various factions were armed and they're still duking it out. And presumably, as much as I understand what you're saying, that they're only concentrating on getting rid of Assad and not thinking about the day after and what's going to happen to all these arms that are pouring in. I had a Syrian filmmaker on yesterday. He just testified before the International Criminal Court. His friends were trying to document atrocities and they were murdered by the regime. He pointed out that the casualties are at least 15,000 and that, in fact, 100,000 people have been taken into prison. And given the nature of that brutal regime, those people may have already been disappeared and there are 50,000 people missing. So already, I think the real casualties, if you take that into account, are far greater than what's being discussed already.
Agreed. I mean, there's no question that the Syrian regime is committing war crimes, that I think the 12,000 figure is a vast understatement. I think it's very difficult at this time to have a sense of what the level of casualties are. I think that in addition to the regime's own tactic of engaging in summary executions, of mass detentions and so forth, on top of that, we're also seeing other armed groups engaging in similar tactics, which is only going to further increase and inflate those numbers. So there's no question that this kind of bloodshed, to the extent that anybody cares about consequences on the ground for Syrian civilians, has to come to an end, and indeed that there's no sustainable future for the Assad regime. I think those are givens. The question is, how do you get there? And to my mind, the only way to get there in a way that minimizes civilian casualties is by engaging in a political process, one in which Russia and Iran are brought to the table precisely so that they put the requisite pressure on Syria. Syria is not responsive to pressure from the United States or Turkey because it's not beholden to the United States or Turkey in its pursuit of its current strategy. The regime is, however, beholden to Iran and Russia, and were those countries to be persuaded that they can be part of a day-after scenario, then you might have, instead of Libya, something like the Yemeni transition, in which you have the regime replaced, stepping down, a transition undertaken politically, but not through increased militarization on the ground of opposition forces, but rather through a negotiation including the backers of the regime. Crucially, in Yemen, the Saleh regime agreed to a transition because its principal backer, Saudi Arabia, pressured it to do so. And Saudi Arabia did that because it was assured that it would continue to have a direct influence on the nature of a subsequent regime, that its own sphere of influence would not be compromised and so forth. And that minimized bloodshed in Yemen. It was not an ideal outcome. I think Egypt is a much more promising outcome in that you have a cleaner break, although, as you've mentioned, there are significant problems in the Egyptian trajectory as well. But it's certainly preferable, the Yemeni trajectory is certainly preferable to the 12,000, 15,000, 150,000, whatever the number may ultimately end up being, civilian deaths and counting that we can now see mounting in Syria.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Aslab Ali.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Aslab Ali, who is an American citizen of Turkish descent. She's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.